Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the TLS podcast. With the summer holidays upon us, now seems a good time to take stock and revisit some memorable moments from a year's worth of podcasts. This week, the medievalist Hetta Howes reviews a new translation of Beowulf, taking us back to the rich and troubling ambiguities of the original, and the historian Ruth Skerr delves into the secretive world of the ritual-loving Freemasons. But first, the TLS's classics editor, Mary Beard, digs through an old exam paper to emphasise the importance of teaching classics in context. Question one, dryads, hyads, naiads, oreads, pleiads. Does classical influence in modern poetry always come down to snobbery and elitism?
Right now, in the professional study of classics, I'm not sure how far it's gone outside this, there's a huge concentration on the uses to which classics has been put over the last 100, 200 years, right? And it tends to, not always, but it tends to be very, very gloomy story, right? And some of that gloom is amply justified. You know, classics has underpinned racism. It has underpinned white supremacy. It has underpinned fascism. And there's no doubt. I wanted to just to point out that that is one side of the story that we need to look at. But there are other sides of the story here. You know, that classics has in some ways in 19th century, it legitimated universal male suffrage. It gave a legitimation to male homosexuality, looking back to 5th century Greece. And it certainly did do a lot for the kind of bolstering of a fascist aesthetic. But don't let's forget Freud, who comes out of a really intense engagement with the classical tradition. And what everybody did Karl Marx do his PhD on? Greek philosophy. So I wanted to say, look, hang on, everybody. There are things to celebrate and things to deplore.
Is it in a sense that it was, when you're studying classics, you also have to think about how classics is thought about and taught? It's as though you're doing historiography while studying history as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think that should be the case with every subject. Just classics has got such a long history that it somehow is even harder to ignore. But you know, for me, classics is not just the study of the ancient world. It's the study of what has happened to that study since the ancient world, between then and now. You know, it's a very thick subject. And you know, I'd like to think that every subject, you know, really needs to look at its history. I mean, you know, people talk about classics being toxic. Well, yeah, I know why they say that. But, you know, I hope nuclear physicists are thinking about the literal toxicity of nuclear physics. And that's not to blame anybody now, but it's just to say we need to look at the history of our subject, whatever subject that is, in the eye. We need to look at who it's attracted, who it's excluded, what uses it's been put, who learnt it, who didn't learn it, and so on. And you know what, you can't ever get a balance sheet. You know, I think to say on balance, I think classics has been better than worse, right? But I think you can start to say there are all kinds of complex ways that classics has had an impact or been used in modern culture and modern politics. And one needs to be sure that one looks at the complexity, you know, not just at the either the bad, or I think, you know, when I was a student, you know, we didn't see the bad, we only saw the good. I think either of these is a wildly simplistic way of looking at a subject. So it was an attempt to say, let's think a bit more nuancedly.
And to do this, you come well prepared because you're able to take us back. I lament the absence of some kind of musical cue here from the Stone Roses or something, but take us back to the 90s, Mary.
Yes, yes, because when I was thinking about this, I remembered that in the early 90s, then again, the end of the decade, around the turn of the millennium, a colleague and I actually did two very similar courses for final year undergraduates in Cambridge about the history of classics. Partly because we were already seeing, you know, there was something that we need to, you know, encourage students to broach and look in the eye without simply taking sides. And so I went to my office. This was long before everything that you've ever taught is on your laptop. You know, now if I wanted to find out what my courses had been 10 years ago, I'd just kind of... I would just search my machine. This was a bit before then. So I went and I found some old box files and I got the stuff out and I found, you know, dissecta membra of these courses and some exam papers, which I think exam papers are always a good way of understanding what the course was teaching. And so I thought there was some quite good questions which people might like to have a go on themselves.
They were brilliant questions. Yeah, it's a sort of, I had a feeling, this is a real confession and just about what a bad student I was, that I used to get sometimes in exams and I would look at the questions and think, gosh, this is really interesting. And straight after that, I would think, I wish I'd worked a bit more. But that's my problem, not yours.
You know, what was interesting for me is that I wouldn't have put them on my blog if I'd been really embarrassed about them, would I? I'd have concealed them. But I thought it was quite interesting because it did reveal slightly different preoccupations of what, pretty well 30 years ago now. I mean, we did, for example, a bit about race in these courses, but we did much more about class. We did much more about the exclusion of women and the exclusion of the British working class. I think if we were doing the courses now, we would think much more about race and diversity. And we were very, very preoccupied, and I think rightly, but again, perhaps with more of an edge than it would be the case now, we were very preoccupied with elitism, you know, and whether, you know, classics in the end had bolstered not just elite cultural values, though in some ways that's clear, but whether it had also really been bolstered snobbery. Now, maybe actually with some members of the current Tory government, one might think it's that question is getting, you know, its edge back again.
Bit of a given.
But I mean, I'm just looking at the questions now, and the first question was really about poetry, very TLS-y kind of subject. And it just said, dryads, hyads, naiads, oreads, pleiads. Does classical influence in modern poetry always come down to snobbery and elitism? Now, I do want to say that I think that any student who answered that question in an hour and just said, yeah, of course it does, you know, all classical influence is really about snobbery, would not have got a great mark, you know. And I think that you'd have wanted to get students, we did want to get students to think about how there's two sides of this, that, you know, just to write off classics as if it's, you know, a justification for being posh and showing that you know more than somebody else would actually end up ignoring some of the important intellectual uses and the, you know, the cultural power that, you know, classics still has. Now, again, you know, now I suppose, you know, 30 years later, looking at modern literature, we would say, hey, hang on a bit. I'm not sure I'm talking about poetry here, but, you know, looking at novels, I think that we'd be very keen to stress that modern writers or fiction, writers of fiction have used classical mythology in ways that entirely or very largely transcended our kind of the accusation of snobbery. So these questions are quite, you know, they challenge you, but if you think there's a simple answer to them, you'd be wrong.
Question 10, what goes when classics goes?
That was my
favourite. Feels particularly sort of loaded and dramatic.
Yes, and it was, you know, it was an attempt, again, to get students to, you know, to see what the subject represented. And you know, insofar as I remember the answers to these, which is only very vaguely, I mean, there are people who were answering that by saying, look, classics is somehow a kind of building block of traditional conservative power in this country. And when it goes, even though I'm having a great time studying it myself, you know, in your course, when it goes, a lot of bad things go with it. And many of these questions, we're really trying to get people to see that easy answers to what the role of an intellectual discipline is are always wrong, you know. So we were looking for complexity, really, and people thinking through partly their own experience of what it's like doing classics, but partly also thinking about what the costs have been, you know. And there's, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that certainly in the 19th century and longer, the British elite used the study of Latin in particular, Greek never quite so much, as a gatekeeper, you know, as a social and political sometimes gatekeeper to keep out people it didn't want.
But even so, if you didn't have it, then how much really wonderful poetry and myth and literature would not be available to anyone? And that's, I would say that's the argument that you teach Latin and Greek to everyone.
That's right. And I think also, as the book by Edith Hall and Henry Stead has recently shown about working class engagement with classics, is that there are also other ways in which people get familiar with classics. You know, the professional educators, you know, tend to think that classics is what you do at school, and it's your irregular verbs, and then you go to university, and it's very much an institutional thing. Whereas actually, and again, this underlays some of the things in these questions, people learn classics in all kinds of different ways. And that, you know, I'm partly talking about, you know, autodidacts and trade union movements, where, you know, the struggles of the Roman plebs was often a very important part of trade union history. But you learn classics through film. I mean, I think it's very interesting when you go to talk at a general meeting and you might say to people, just, do you know anything about the classical world? And the answer will often be, oh, no, I don't know a thing. But, you know, you press a little bit and, you know, going back a few years now, but they know about gladiators. They've seen the movie Gladiator. They know what the Colosseum's for.
There's quite a lot of, there's a lot of really good kids' books as well. So I think a lot of kids now would say they've learned it, or imbibed it, not learned, that might be the wrong word, through books and cartoons and graphic novels, all that sort of stuff. There's some really creative, interesting stuff going on. In fact, there's a brilliant new video game called Hades, which I've learned a bit from. Let me tell you, it's really good. I won't go on about it. That could be for another podcast, maybe.
You know, I think it's, you know, as soon as you start pressing at these questions, you see that, you know, there's an awful lot more to the history of classics than being the legitimator of fascist architecture, even though that was part of the story.
Was this, well, I suppose this is two questions. A, was this a popular course you know, did you find students kind of coming alive in on this module? And then also, has this way of teaching it sort of now been spread out across in most institutions? Obviously, it will vary wildly from institution to institution, but would you say that in general it has been spread out, this concern, across the teaching? It's been absorbed rather than requiring its own module.
I'd like to be so optimistic, but I mean, just going back to the course at the time, it was one of the most exciting courses I'd ever taught, you know, partly because back then people didn't really think about the history of the subjects they were doing. And I suppose in part that answers your second question there. But I mean, I remember we spent quite a lot of time having people talk about how they got into classics, you know, at school, you know, what kind of teachers they'd had. And some of those were idiosyncratic stories and everybody's story was slightly different. But it did reveal, you know, there were patterns to what, to how people got into it. And we have, I mean, one of the questions that we've got in this exam paper is, have ancient Greek and Latin rightly been presented and taught as difficult languages? Now, quite a lot of our students back then used to say, I got into it because my teachers said that I would really thrive on doing something difficult. And so they recommended I did Latin because that would be intellectually challenging. So it there was a kind of sense in which classics advertised itself as difficult. Now, there's nothing more or less difficult about Latin than there is about any language. It's just that there are some things that are very hard to read in it, but you know, but there is a mystique, you know, and this, but part of the what happened in classics, I think, was a social and cultural mystique, but part of it was this kind of, it was what the really brainy kids did. So a lot of these people who then ended up in Cambridge doing classics, they'd been kind of singled out to do it. So there was good chat about the different forms of elitism, both bad and good.
It also sounds a bit off-putting, doesn't it? A bit eat your veg, come and do Latin because it's really difficult.
Come and do Latin, it's really difficult. But actually, kids can be quite counter-suggestible. and yeah. You know, I think that there were also very small classes. I mean, I'm sure, look, if you've gone to some big old-fashioned public school, you'd find the whole lot of them doing Latin. But in most schools that the kids had been to, it was a very kind of privileged thing to do because it was a very small class. There was three of you doing Latin A level. And so you had a completely different relationship with the teacher. And people remembered their classics teachers absolutely vividly. And I remember always used to claim, I'm not sure it's true, that people remembered their Latin teacher so much more vividly than anybody ever remembered their geography teacher. And you know, that wasn't because there weren't great geography teachers, but because classics and the process of learning classics did have this very intimate kind of style to it. But Theo, you also asked about whether this now isn't necessary. And whether this has been incorporated.
Oh, no, I mean, not sorry, just to clarify, not so much that I think it's unnecessary now, but just whether that self-reflexiveness has been absorbed and built in more.
No, sure, that's right. You don't need a special course. Like, you know, like you might say, I'm not sure this is right, that, you know, we used to have loads of courses about women in the ancient world, you know, somehow as if it was a special thing.
They were there.
Yeah, that's right. Now you expect any course that you teach in classics to include women as well as men. You know, it's, so in a sense, the success of those old courses is revealed in that you don't seem to need them quite so much anymore because they've won. To some extent, I think that's true about this course. And I think there's a lot more in almost every classics department now about the reception of classics, you know, about, you know, Derek Walcott and the Odyssey, modern performances of Greek tragedy and so forth. I think that the idea of undergraduates as a kind of absolutely essential part of their course, you know, thinking about the history of it, I think that we didn't win on that. These were subjects that were done, these were courses that were done by people who opted to do them. They weren't for everybody. Now, I think what's quite interesting is that now our undergraduates, who are very kind of concerned about the toxicity of the subject, want this to be a kind of compulsory element, you know. And I find myself, you know, and this is where, you know, being 66 is both a blessing and a curse. I find myself saying, don't imagine that you invented this subject, you know. I was teaching this before you were born, sunshine. But I think that, you know, I predict, and I think there's already plans in Cambridge, that we will in the next couple of years be having a much more mainstream course about the history of classical scholarship and its impact and its effects. And, you know, in some ways this would be, this course has kind of been resurrected in a slightly different form.
Okay, well, Mary Beard, then, if you just would like to choose one question from your list of 10, the one that is closest to your heart, to set as a challenge to our listeners.
Right. Well, shall I? It's quite hard, but...
Our listeners can handle that, I'm confident.
Okay. Of course, they're extremely self-selected. bunch of things. Has classics traditionally harboured and sanctioned deviance from and transgression against the norms of modern society? Because that was a question. Let me just give you a hint, oh listener, if you're thinking of doing that, that there is a very sort of strong version that you often hear that classics is always legitimates the conservative. You know, Prince Charles, conservative architecture, classical architecture. Right. Well, what about the ways that classics has sanctioned deviance? Can I have a?
I'm thinking of D.H. Lawrence immediately.
That might be, I think.
About Catullus.
All these would be very good starts to your essays.
So, can I do my essay on number 10, please? Can I just say that actually on Mary's blog, all 10 questions are there. So if people want to look at all 10 questions, that's where they are. People are allowed to choose their own, though. Has chosen one for you.
Answers on a postcard, a really, really long one. So more of a scroll, really.
You have 1 hour only.
That's not enough.
Mary Beard, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Talking to us about why classics shouldn't remain in the past. Still to come, myths and rituals as we review a new translation by a woman of the old English poem Beowulf, and we pull back the curtain on the Freemasons. And if you like what you've heard so far, please do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss an episode.
It's difficult to do it well. It's easy to be mean about something not well. And actually, that's one of the disappointing things about this piece that suddenly got so much airtime. And, you know, there's even a question of whether we should be discussing it now, because it's probably got enough mileage. But I think it is important to discuss it because of the things it failed to do. And it was a review by Barry Pearce in the Irish Times of Dolly Alston's Ghosts. And without wishing to launch a hatchet job on a hatchet job, it was rubbish. It wasn't funny. It wasn't stylish. It told us nothing about the book itself. I mean, this is one of the things. It was very much about the reviewer. I think the words I, me and my appeared in almost every sentence.
I think those labels, they all really annoy me. Actually, I find them fantastically unhelpful because they're either used to punch up or punch down. And really, it just means that a lot of people enjoyed reading the book. Well, then Hilary Mantel is middle brow, and so is Shakespeare, and so is Ulysses. A lot of people have enjoyed Ulysses. Actually, that you probably can't make that case. I need to rescind that point. You talk about one glaring omission, the man you call the Voldemort of the book. Can you reveal who this is?
It's of course, Jose Mourinho. And the reason that it's a bit curious that Wenger doesn't mention him at all is that he had a great rivalry with him, from which he came off second best, one has to admit. And it seems that this kind of attitude that he had to Wenger, constantly teasing him and poking the bear, has left a lasting impression in that he just doesn't mention him at all. He does mention Alex Ferguson, with whom he had a lot of rivalry, but he calls it in the book a classic rivalry.
And we are happy to announce the return of the exclusive TLS subscription offer. Exclusive, that is, to our podcast listeners. For just £5 or $5, or the equivalent in whatever currency you use, you will receive 6 issues of the TLS, and that's print and digital. So there's really quite a lot to be getting on with. Go to the-tls.co.uk/pod to take up this offer.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Later on, we'll be revealing the secrets behind the ancient brotherhood of the Freemasons. But first, to Beowulf, that most translated of all Old English poems, first committed to the page some 1,000 years ago. Very few women have taken on the work, however, and yet one has tackled it twice in quick succession. Maria Davana Headley first rewrote the work from a modern-day female perspective in her book The Mere Wife back in 2018, and now she's taking on the text itself. The medievalist Hetta Howes has read them both and joined us to discuss.
Famously, the translator facing this text has to make a bold, defining decision from the very first word. So what is that first challenge?
Yeah, so that's kind of, I imagine, what most translators will spend the most time on. And it's not a short poem. And that first word is "hwat," which is Old English for all kinds of different things. It's, you know, there's all kinds of ways you could translate that. It's a convention to start a lot of Old English poetry with that word. And it essentially is a word that sort of says, okay, listen up. So different ways of translating it might be listen, low has been one use that I don't particularly like, hear, so, well, any kind of sort of dialectic marker that a story is about to begin, it's time to sit up and listen. So how a translator handles that word, I think, tells us quite a lot about what's coming.
Exactly, it completely sets the tone for everything else that follows. So how does Headley kick things off then?
Headley's is my favourite ever, and hers is bro, which is a really bold choice. And I think it tells us from the start of that translation that she's taking no prisoners with her translation, and she's making fierce choices, and it's going to work. bro is sort of the best way I can imagine to start such a macho poem.
It's bro with an exclamation mark, isn't it? It's not like bro, listen, it's like bro.
Yes.
This is what's going on. It makes it sound a bit like Point Break from the beginning.
Absolutely. And it puts, I think, in our head exactly the kind of person that might speak to another bro like that, like bro at the pub. I have to say, when I was reading this translation, you know, bearing in mind pubs have been closed on and off for a long time now, I was like, oh, it really made me think of being in the pub.
It's sort of, I mean, this choice, bro, it sort of flies in the face of well, of tradition, but of Tolkien as well, because didn't he sort of counsel against colloquialisms?
Yes, Tolkien's opinion was that, you know, translations should almost be quite archaic, because the diction of the original poem is quite a high register, so it's quite elevated. And so Tolkien argued that, you know, translators should be sensitive to that, whereas Headley is doing almost the exact opposite. It brings it right into the sort of modern world. It's sort of a word that might not mean anything in 10 or 20 years, or might not have the same resonance. But I think that's why it works so well. You know, Beowulf is very much a poem of its moment, and Headley's making it a poem of our moment as well.
And it also acknowledges, as you touched on before, doesn't it, that this has been, is, and has been a very male poem. Looking back over a list of previous English translations alone, there are very few women's names there. There's I saw Mary Waterhouse in 1949, Megan Purvis in 2013, but this is a poem about men, for men, written by a man.
Yes, and I think that's why it was sort of high time for a woman to translate it, because actually, whilst it is very much, you know, I'm not going to try and make the case today that it's really a woman's poem, it's not, but there are more interesting sort of ideas about women in there than we've perhaps seen traditionally, because of critical interest has often been historically from men, translated by men historically, or more popularly by men. So, and I think there's something about the culture of the poem. It's a warrior culture. Most of the characters are male. There's a lot of kind of exploration of what it means to be a good hero or a good king, both of which in the context of the time would have meant to be a man. What makes a good man? So I think it has, you know, I teach Beowulf, and one of the challenges is sort of getting my largely sort of female student body to see that it's a poem that might have interest for them as well.
Well, they've always got the opportunity to pour the drinks, which is what people, the ladies seem to do mostly in Beowulf, as far as I can tell.
Yes. In fact, you know, their role is very much to kind of keep the peace and serve the drinks. Yeah. You know, Waelfio is one of the only women in it, sort of wife of Hrothgar. And she sort of is, you know, she needs to look pretty and make sure everyone's wine cup is full. And actually, a student in a presentation just last week said, well, it seems that largely women are sort of about service in this poem. And I was like, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think Headley manages in her translation to make those issues come to the surface so we can interrogate them, rather than just sort of presenting them as oh, this is what women are. She kind of is quite tongue-in-cheek about it, and quite playful about that kind of role assigned to women in the poem.
And this picks up on Headley's previous work, doesn't it? The Mere Wife from 2018, that was a modern day retelling rather than translation of Beowulf, and it was from the perspective of Grendel's mother.
Yes, and if anyone listening has not read it, please read it immediately and then read Headley's translation. The Mere Wife is an astonishing book, and as you say, it's a feminist adaptation retelling, and its sort of key themes are sort of motherhood and sort of what it means to be a woman, but also toxic masculinity and some fairly big themes as well: colonization, gentrification, politics. You know, it covers quite a lot of ground. But I read The Mere Wife a couple of years ago, and I was so excited by it, and sort of the way it engaged with the poem in a way I hadn't really seen before. And so when I heard that Headley was also translating Beowulf, I was like, okay, this is going to be good. And I was quite nervous to read it in case it wasn't, and it was so good. It was so good.
And one of the things that she circles back to again and again then in both books, it seems, is the double standard, really. And this is something that I think has been touched on before in terms of Beowulf. It's sort of been wrangled with and smoothed out over time, but basically how if a man chops off a rival's head, he's a warrior hero, whereas if a woman does it, she's a monster, a dragon.
Yeah, there's a wonderful kind of parallelism in the poem, which is kind of under the surface, but I think is very much present in the original, a kind of ambivalence about how we treat outsiders. So you've got, you know, those within Hrothgar's hall, the sort of main warriors who are celebrated for wreaking havoc, causing a lot of death, you know, brawling, fighting, wars. And then when it's outsiders, whether that's Grendel, the sort of male monster, or more interestingly for me as mother, that's perceived in a completely different way. So as you say, there's sort of a moment where Grendel's mum puts the head of a warrior outside her mirror because her son's been killed and she's avenging him, which is exactly what, according to the culture, she should do. But in the poem, there's a sense of, oh, you know, how could she do this terrible thing? What a monstrous person. So I think the poem is inviting us quite subtly to sort of think about those inconsistencies, how we perceive other people, who's inside, who's outside. And that's something that Headley certainly seems engaged with in her translation, bringing those sort of double standards to the surface, whether that's double standards of gender or just double standards of who happens to be in the club and who doesn't happen to be in the club.
Can I ask, in terms of that ambiguity, and I'm not sure if I've understood this right, is it right that there is that same one word that can be glossed as or sometimes used as warrior when it's talking about Beowulf, but then monster when it's talking about Grendel or the dragon, and it's the same word, is that right?
Yes, and this is something that kind of got more attention, started to be paid to it from the 80s onwards, with the sort of rise of second wave feminism, actually, and more critics started paying attention to the language and how particularly Grendel's mum was translated. But there's this word, Aglecha, which in Old English can mean sort of warrior or hero, but could also mean monster or wretch. And interestingly, in some editions, famously Friedrich Kleber's edition, which is still very influential today, whenever the word Aglecha is used, if it's used in reference to Beowulf or another male hero, he glosses that word as warrior. But when it's used for Grendel or Grendel's mum, it's glossed as monster or wretch. And there's nothing about that word that would sort of invite us to categorize that much in the original. It can mean both, and context, of course, is important, but I think additions which don't nod to that ambiguity are losing something from the original poem, and certainly translations as well that don't nod to that ambiguity, because part of the sort of wonder of the poem is you don't ever quite know where you stand. And yes, Beowulf is portrayed as a great hero, but he's also a bit superhuman, and, you know, it's sort of interested in the lines between humanity and monstrosity. So the treatment of that word has historically been quite revealing about sort of our attitudes to the poem, particularly with this tradition of sort of male editors and translators, I think.
Hetta Howe's talking to us about Maria Devani Headley's translation of Beowulf. And finally, we turn to the Freemasons. This famous fraternal organisation traces their origins to the 13th century stonemasons, but today their practices are the stuff of legend. Supposed former members include Mozart and even the first president of the United States, George Washington. The historian Ruth Skerr joined us to try to shed light on who the real Freemasons are.
Notoriously, Freemasonry and its history is complex. A very basic definition from the Encyclopedia Britannica is the largest worldwide secret society. But in his book, John Dickey points out that many Freemasons today contest the idea that they belong to a secret society. Instead, they see themselves as belonging to a society or club that has secrets. So a more accurate definition would be the largest fraternal and charitable institution in the United Kingdom, or perhaps even the world. The origins of Freemasonry can be traced to Scotland in the 16th century to a man named William Shaw, who is thought to be the first man in Scotland to be referred to as an architect. The term Freemason originally referred to a mason who worked in free stone, so fine-grained sandstone or limestone. Dickey explains that the name became associated with the accepted Masons during the turmoil of the English Civil War, and simultaneously with a set of secrets which, quotes, must never be written. These include passwords, signs, and handshakes. Much later, under the British Empire, Freemasonry was widely exported around the world.
And then it grew into the society. I have to say, in that definition, the thing that surprises me is it's one of the largest charitable foundations.
Yes, being an upright person in the community and doing charitable works is a very important part of the understanding of being a Freemason.
At what point then did something that sounds quite dry and serious, you know, body to regulate the craft of masonry and its and its dealings with the authorities and so on. At what point did that start to become bound up with conspiracy theories and the secret handshakes you alluded to, all that sort of thing? I mean, is the darker side much more recent? Was there a kind of triggering event, or how did it come about?
So the conspiracy theories had a huge impetus during the French Revolution. And so before the revolution, Freemasonry had been very important in France. And during the revolution, there was a big clampdown on it. And the Roman Catholic historians of the revolution started to suggest that the revolution had been prepared by the Freemasons. So then the sense that there was some kind of conspiracy or secrecy that was anti-Roman Catholic in the French context became very prominent. And I had a strange sort of personal experience of that, because when I published my book on Robespierre, I sent it to the Roman Catholic priest I'd known in my childhood. And he wrote back to me saying that he thought it was obvious Robespierre was a Freemason, a terrible person. He hated my book and he was going to put it in the church jumble sale.
Did you put that on the back of the cover as one of the blurbs?
Obviously, I was really upset at the time. But I've come to realise that he was just part of that old hostility between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in France in particular.
Certainly things like the scandal in Italy in the 70s and 80s, which, you know, roped in bankers and politicians and industrialists. And I mean, that must have tarnished the Freemasons' image.
Yeah.
So much.
When I was looking online, I wish I'd gone to it at the time, I saw this review of it, of an interesting exhibition at the Grand Masonic Lodge in London. And they had put on an exhibition about the impact of the revolution on Freemasonry. Because at the time, when the revolution happened in France, Freemasonry in Britain was at its highest point, and they had just completed that grand building in the middle of London, etc. And then obviously the conspiracy theories and the suspicion of the Masons sort of started to come across the channel and took them, you know, in a sense by surprise, I think, because they had become very recognised and very sort of respectable in Britain.
So I was going to say, I thought they were very respectable. And you say, I'm sorry, I'm sort of slightly jumping ahead to something else you say later on in the piece, that you say that it could be revolutionary and reactionary. But was it, because there's sort of two sides, aren't there? Did it reinforce the class differences? Or say in the revolution, was it a way for people to come together and actually erode class differences and sort of do good works?
Yeah, well, I think I really agree with the main point of Dickey's book, which is that you always have to look really carefully at the social context to understand how Freemasonry is operating. I mean, that's his main thing is, you know, instead of getting hung up on trying to penetrate and understand the sort of the secrets, that's not so important. What's more important is to see how Freemasonry functions in different times and different places. So with the revolutionary and reactionary contrast, I think it's actually more about the relationship between Freemasonry and the state than about the relationship between classes within the state. So certain states at different times have been incredibly hostile to Freemasons, and others have regarded Freemasons as useful for furthering the state's purposes. And whilst the French Revolution more or less put an end to Freemasonry in France, afterwards it underwent a huge revival under Napoleon.
That's interesting in itself, though, because, I mean, Dickey, you point out how he assembles a large cast of characters and some of them are well-known, you know, Benjamin Franklin, Rudyard Kipling, they were Masons. But, I mean, do we get a sense of the role that the organisation did play in their lives? Because, you know, what they got from it, so to speak, because we know that you're not allowed to, or we believe that you're not allowed to talk politics, you're not allowed to talk about religion
that's right.
as a Mason, are you?
So, I mean, in that sense, I suppose it's difficult because they probably don't write down or leave memoirs about what they gained from being members. They would probably not be very common to do that. I was reading, I mean, I know we might come to this later, the idea of women who are in Britain excluded from being Masons, but that wasn't true on the continent. And Napoleon's wife, Josephine, was a Mason before she met him and continued to be involved in that. I was reading about research being done in her letters. Sometimes she signs them with the parallel lines and that are considered to be signs of Masonic membership. So I guess there might be in people's archives and letters signs that you wouldn't necessarily be noticing unless you were looking for it.
The sort of the written equivalent of the secret handshake type thing.
Exactly.
So let's talk about women. I mean, before I read your piece, I didn't know that women were allowed in any form at all. So was Josephine like a full member of a lodge?
So it's complicated. Yes. So on the continent, there were lodges for women and they have a sort of special status, and she certainly was. And then obviously under Napoleon's regime, when Freemasonry becomes protected and starts to flourish, his brothers are Freemasons. Josephine's son is a Freemason, and she certainly, there are accounts of her being initiated into a lodge in Strasbourg in 1805. And I'm not sure where it is, but you allegedly we have her apron, her Masonic apron, which is the first gift that you receive when you enter a lodge. And that is a symbol that goes right back to the guilds and the trades and the sort of the working aprons that tradesmen would have worn to protect themselves.
Well, when you think of, because there is a personal connection for Dickie, you know, he doesn't say that he is a Mason. We don't think he is a Mason, but his grandfather, he mentions, was a Scottish railwayman. Yes. He became a Freemason in Aberdeen in 1919. And you say, like many thousands of soldiers returning from the Great War, you know, a substitute sense of camaraderie.
Exactly.
Or, you know, also satisfying that desire maybe for pomp if they were in the, you know, the upper echelons of the army, say.
It's interesting in the Dickie book, because although he does talk about the way in which in some instances women were able to be in these lodges that were accepted, and there's all kinds of complicated rules around that, essentially he does present Freemasonry as a brethren, as a brotherhood, as a sort of very male eccentric, almost like a cult really, and the whole point of it is this sort of male friendship at the heart of it. So that's a very important argument in the book.
And I think you say that his line on the secrecy says the point of the secrecy is secrecy itself, i.e. to make it mysterious, but not that any of the terrible things will actually happen if you break the rules.
Yes. So he quotes, I mean, he's got a sort of humorous tone, Dickie, and that's not because he's being dismissive. I mean, I think that's because he is looking at this from the outside. So he's trying to explain, well, all these, you know, you'll be cut in half, you'll be burned if you break the secrets of the fraternity, etc. What he argues is that, you know, the point of all this secrecy is, as you say, the secrecy itself. And I think what he's doing there is saying, look, you know, Freemasons aren't really hiding anything. It's a sort of counter argument to the conspiracy theories. And in the past, that the fact that there were secrets associated with the Freemasons has caused a lot of trouble and suspicion and even persecution in some cases. So I think he's picking up really on that distinction that I mentioned earlier between a secret society and a society that has secrets. And he's very much on the side of the Freemasons. And he's saying, all right, you know, they've got some supposedly secret rituals, but actually it's not that difficult to find out, you know, what some of them are. And you know, he gives a short account of the initiation ceremonies, etc.
He does describe it as a cult of death, though. What does that actually mean?
He doesn't actually describe it as a cult of death. What he says is it's about death and ultimately about overcoming your fear of death. And for that reason, it uses symbols of death, or he calls them emblems of mortality, like skulls and bones and tombs and urns. And it incorporates all those things into its rituals. But it's not a deathly, or I mean, from some people have suspected a sort of satanic kind of cult at all. It's an attempt to actually overcome the fear of death through these rituals, which incorporate those signifiers of death into the practices.
To go back to Napoleon, you say that Josephine was I'm talking about Napoleon because I know that you've got a book coming out on Napoleon.
Yes.
So we'll just have a bit of pre-publicity there.
Thank you.
So most of his family were, and Josephine was. Do we know whether he was?
So this is a subject of huge interest and debate, as you can imagine. And some people think he was, but there's no evidence that he was. And in fact, when he was in exile on St. Helena, he made some pretty disparaging remarks, comparing Freemasonry to a pile of imbeciles who assemble for good cheer and the execution of many ridiculous follies. So there's a sense that he was not up for wearing the apron and, participating in the ceremonies. However, he was hugely tolerant of Freemasonry. In 1798, when Napoleon leads the army into Egypt, there were definitely Freemasons who accompanied him, and they become very struck by the imagery in Egypt, the pyramids and the symbols, etc., and they bring that back to France, and it enters into this new revival of Freemasonry that is happening there.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the TLS podcast, produced by Ben Mitchell, looking back at the past year on this show. We'll be back in September with a return to regular programming. But in the meantime, issues of the TLS continue to appear every week, and our summer double issue towards the end of this month looks set to be quite something. So why not look into a print and digital subscription? You'll find a special subscription offer just for podcast listeners in this episode's description. But for now, from Thea Lenarduzzi and from me, goodbye and see you in September.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.